Hello, I'm Brian.
I'm Caroline.
I'm Claire.
And this is the Computer Weekly
Downtime Upload
podcast.
Also back on the podcast today is Mr. Ryan Priest, the satirist of Computer Weekly, author of most of our downtimes, satirical columns.
Yeah, I pretty much write all of them, I think. Last time I checked, about 98%.
Cool. And your recent big topic has been the election.
Yeah, over the last few weeks, the Tories have been pretty hard to ignore with all of their sort of new Machiavellian tech tricks. So we're going to be talking about that a little bit today.
Look forward to hearing about that. So we'll be coming on to those after our Tech on the Stump segment. Caroline, the manifestos are out.
Mm-hmm. There's lots to pick over, lots of talk about tech. Some have gone into more detail than others in their manifestos, but yeah, well, lots to talk about.
And you're also going to talk about Google.
Yeah, Google Cloud Next, the conference last week, which was very interesting, and with a surprise guest star, Gareth Southgate.
Cool, and I was in San Francisco last week with Salesforce, their Dreamforce event, their annual Jamboree, which also featured David Beckham, so there might be a little link there. Claire, you're going to talk about
StemX and Monster, the job website. They've partnered up for their annual Monster Confidence events across the UK.
Cool. But first we're going to do something that's very unusual for any British media outlet, and that's we're going to talk about the Liberal Democrats.
So just to get right out the gate, the last two podcasts I have talked a lot about tax, about IR35 and loan charge. So the big policy thing in the Liberal Democrats that they have announced is that if they were to come to power, they would scrap the loan charge policy completely, which would be of great relief to many IT contractors facing six-figure, life-changing tax bills on the result of that. And they said they would also review IR35 and maybe not necessarily scrap it, but maybe think another way of enforcing that. Aside from that, there's lots, probably out of all three of the main party manifestos, the Lib Dems one is probably the most comprehensive tech-wise. Obviously with Labour we've had the flagship announcement about their free broadband pledge, that kind of caught a lot of headlines. But
it did, yeah.
But
a lot of coverage of that.
Yeah. Mm. But I'd say, yeah, the Lib Dem one, they have, like lots of organisations, gone big on artificial intelligence. They think we can become a world leader in ethical, inclusive new technology, including AI.
Right.
Yeah. They want to invest in education to equip people with the skills they need to use new technology or to create new technologies.
Right.
And they also want to position the UK as the best place to work if you're a tech person in the world as well.
Did they say how they were doing all of these magical things?
Yep.
Okay, good. Great.
This is quite interesting actually. They want to boost tech skills in the sector, but rather than sort of focusing exclusively on coding and things like that, they want to see logic, verbal reasoning and creativity taught more widely in schools.
Mm-hmm.
So going in at that approach rather than like, you know, can you do more coding please?
Oh, that's interesting.
That kind of makes sense, because there's this sort of opinion in the tech industry that technology shouldn't necessarily be divided up into its own subject.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So rather than teaching technology is kind of like a learn how to code, it should be here's how you can use technology across the curriculum.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Because it just sort of, you know, like if you go into a job, they're not gonna sit you down and be like, okay, code this thing. You're gonna be, you know, writing emails as well and
having
using logic and
teamwork, all that kind of stuff.
Imagination.
Collaborate with people. Like, no, sorry, I only know how to code, I cannot talk to you.
I don't know how to collaborate.
So that's part of it. They also want to create this thing called the Lovelace Code of Ethics to ensure that personal data and artificial intelligence is processed in unbiased ways.
Okay.
That's quite a feat, though.
Ooh.
Yeah. Like I say, they're very ambitious, but so if they get in power, they've got a lot of work to do.
And this might be connected with the Ada Lovelace Institute, which is all about that.
Is it?
Ooh.
Possibly. But there was something that was quite interesting as well, that they want to, obviously, with the big tech giants and everything, they make a lot of profit off of our data. So they want to introduce mechanisms by which the public would get rewarded for the fact that they will make money off our own personal data and things like that. I don't know exactly, it just says, allow the public to share in profits made by tech companies in the use of their data.
Don't companies think that the service that they provide as a result of using your data is profit enough? Isn't that the point?
Yeah, but at the same time, this was elsewhere in their manifesto actually, on the tax stuff, is that they want the tech giants to be taxed more fairly because they have various ways and means that mean that they don't always pay as much tax.
Yeah.
They make a lot of money in this country, but they don't always pay a proportionate amount of tax.
And their former leader works for Facebook.
Yeah.
So all of them are coming for the tech giants.
Yeah. But no, that might be part of that, I think. But I don't know, because, like I say, the technology bit is separate to the tax bit, even though they are kind of related.
And how would you say like that compares with like the Tory manifesto and the Labour one, like in terms of like ambition? Well, obviously, like there's the broadband stuff, which is seen as like Labour's really ambitious pledge. But where would you say they fit in between the other two major parties?
Well, I think that's the thing almost that this one is missing. There's lots of like lots of ideas and lots of okay, we can do this, we can do this, but nothing has grabbed the attention like
Labour's. Yeah, it's like poster boy.
Yeah.
An interesting thing about that is that the Liberals, they can only put in their manifesto stuff that's been passed by party conference, whereas that kind of rabbit out of a hat that John McDonnell pulled with the broadband pledge, he just made that up with his his policy team, his special advisors. That wasn't passed through Labour Party conference, so they are quite kind of rigid.
Yeah.
Like, I didn't want them to. They just basically have to establish it ahead of time, and that's...
It has to be exhausted.
They can't adapt it.
Amazing. Yeah, I mean, Labour, there were other bits in their manifesto, so it's not just broadband. They want to make sure the NHS data is not exploited by international technology and pharmaceutical corporations.
Oh, yeah.
As well, which, again, this kind of fight back against big tech, using it, coming in here, using our data.
Especially American companies,
The
NHS is not for sale, and so on.
Mm.
Which does seem to be like a creeping theme now that's returning, and the Tories keep insisting, it's not for sale. But then Corbyn sort of pulls out a document that literally shows that they have had discussions. But then, Boris Johnson just says something silly and that distracts it.
Well, that's pretty much what their manifesto is, to be honest. A bit silly. Because I didn't have, it was like 58 pages long, and I was like, I don't have time to read all of that, I just need the tech stuff.
Yeah.
So I did a word search through the document for technology. And it's just technology. It's just like, oh, we're going to use technology to improve the NHS, and we'll use technology to build more houses, and we'll use technology. Like, what technology?
When, like, we're going to be commissioning hoverboards.
Yeah. Not even that precise. It's just technology.
Just technology. Okay, cool.
A lot of technology.
That is how it feels across pretty much all of the manifestos, I think, is that just using tech as buzzwords. It feels... to me, like, it's been written by someone who's not a huge expert in tech.
Yeah.
It's just like, we're going to take advantage of the technology that is happening in the future.
They've got
us.
Thesaurus.
Yeah.
And then when someone says, what tech? They're just like flicking through, like, AI.
Blockchain.
One of their policies is, we will embrace new technologies and crack down on online crimes.
Cool.
How?
That sounds great.
Wait, get the thesaurus out.
Why is no other party endorsing that?
We will create a new national cyber crime force and empower the police to safely use new technologies like biometrics and artificial intelligence. But they're not new. Like, we've had those for ages. And along with the use of DNA, which is a very old technology.
Oh, no, not DNA.
They've also got their broadband pledge as well, which has been doing the rounds for a little while. I think that was pre-announced even before the election was, or at least talked about. But it's not free, so that's it's not like
that. Doesn't really.
Who cares? Give us free stuff.
So do you feel like overall, just vaguely throughout the parties, other than obviously this big, exciting broadband pledge from Labour, do you think it just seems a bit like tech is sort of overlooked? It's just they kind of humour the public there and just give a vague outline of what is possible through tech.
Like I say, definitely looking through the Tory manifesto, it just feels like they're using tech as just a silver bullet, like, just, oh, we'll just say it and then we'll just, hopefully it will sort out all our problems.
I think they rely on a majority of people not understanding how tech can be used either. If they say AI can fix it, who is, you know, like a normal person to say... But have you thought about bias in data sets that feed AI and stuff like that? They're just going to go like, oh, okay.
Yeah, no, I agree. And I think, as well, I don't know if, like, I might be making a sweeping generalisation here, but I don't know if it sort of speaks a bit to the age of the possible people who vote for these different parties. So, like, Conservatives, like, yeah, that's enough. Mm. That's all we need to know. I'm not going to do any more into that. Whereas maybe Liberal Democrats might have a slightly younger voting demographic. Yeah. I don't know, who might be more questioning of stuff like this. So they have gone really deep and broad into the kind of, like, this is how we're going to build this. It's not just a case of saying we're going to have technology. Here's, like, an ethics board we're going to create. We're going to, you know, create more job fees and stuff. There's a lot more detail in that. And then, yeah, Labour, just give free broadband to everyone. And then once you kids are old enough to vote, your Fortnite games, you can play as much as possible. But, no, I didn't see all the debates, but, yeah, there wasn't really a lot of tech talk to be found.
I can't remember any big tech questions. Even the broadband pledge from Labour, I thought maybe Johnson was going to use that as an opportunity to sort of call it a communist scheme or something like that again.
Yeah, he has
called it that at least once or twice.
But he didn't in the debate,
No, he was actually quite gentle in that debate. And I was surprised, even at the end, he didn't have very good patter, which I thought he would at least wipe the floor with Corbyn on that side of it. But when they asked a silly question at the end, like, what would you choose to get each other for a Christmas present? Corbyn came up with Scrooge, like the story of Scrooge.
Christmas Carol,
And Boris Johnson just sort of floundered and just struggled.
He does seem to be at the moment, doesn't he? There's a few things he's been caught unawares, just with, like, he's probably rehearsed and rehearsed his, like, what he, his talking points, and then when someone asks him, like, a normal question, he's going quite veering into that kind of Fields of Wheat thing, like Theresa May famously come unstuck on.
Is anyone else just constantly aware of this sort of invisible energy of Dominic Cummings, though? Even if Boris Johnson comes across terribly, you think, this is the plan.
They've got some
kind of master plan here. They're playing with my mind.
Yeah, he's pulling the strings.
So, Ryan, the election's been a rich scene for you in terms of stories, hasn't it?
It has. And, like, over the last few weeks, I keep saying that I want to try and avoid it and just find a silly story, like, I don't know, Elon Musk smashing up his latest Tesla or something. But then the Conservatives do something that it feels wrong to ignore, because Emily Maitlis put it to James Cleverly, the chairman of the Conservative Party, that it's dystopian, and I thought that was, like, the most powerful word to use for
it.
So I wrote a downtime comparing the tactics such as the Conservatives during that debate we were just discussing. At the very same time, they were talking about the importance of keeping integrity in this election. The Conservative Party press office were transforming their Twitter page into, I think it was called, what was it called? Fact Check UK. And basically just camouflaging themselves as some kind of impartial group and was sort of debasing everything that Labour said based on that.
Do you think that was a Dominic Cummings masterstroke?
I'm not sure where that come from, but in my downtime I did suggest the similarities between that kind of strategy to a Russian strategy used by, like, the key advisor to Putin, which is his name is Vladislav Surkov, and he has helped keep Putin in power through, basically, he's been distributing misinformation over the years, conflicting information, he's been supporting various conflicting parties, and that confuses the opposition. You almost don't know what you're fighting against. And I think it's interesting to see there've been a few moments in this election so far with Keir Starmer's interview on Good Morning Britain being doctored by the Tory party and distributed. I'm starting to see a few similarities, so it'll be interesting to watch and see if they continue down that path. Because it is a little bit disconcerting.
And the title of that story was, "What's the Story, Morphing Tory?"
I pat myself on the back for that.
Your headlines are brilliant.
Thank you.
What comes first, headline or story?
The story, usually,
Like a true journalist.
That's me.
And any more?
Yeah.
Well, there was another one a couple of weeks ago, which kind of dovetails with, I think, what you're going to be talking about in a minute with
the Dreamforce Festival.
Just the stark comparison of homeless people on the streets next to this big glamorous festival with billionaires. So I did a downtime about billionaires the other week, how they often get defended for the amount they donate to charity. So I think only this week it was announced that Jeff Bezos has given away, I think, about $98 million. But when you look at actually the incomings of these huge tech billionaires, they can't actually give it away at a rate that they get it back. So it's not even really a criticism on billionaires. It's more just a system in the world that's got out of control. As much as they give away, their net worth is swelling year on year so much. So I don't know how I found humour in that. But check out the downtime if you're interested in billionaires. That one's called Enema at the Gates because it's about Piers Morgan basically praising Bill Gates.
Well, the co-founder of co-CEO of Salesforce is Marc Benioff, and he's worth something like $3.2 billion, or at least he was a few years ago. But compared to Larry Ellison, is worth about 50.
Mm-hmm.
Wow. Or the Giggle Boys, who between them are worth 60.
That's their boy band name.
He's a pauper. So last week, as I said, I was at Dreamforce in San Francisco. One of the coolest things was seeing Obama speaking, and he was very, very cool. Everyone was excited.
Yeah.
15,000 people in the hall were very excited indeed. Probably mostly Democrat inclined folk. Doing a fireside chat with Benioff, I think, gives quite a lot of money to Democrat causes and to the Obama's Foundation and things like that. And Michelle Obama's also spoken at Dreamforce before. But yeah, it was an interesting talk that he gave. There was one bit where it was almost like a West Wing moment, where Obama was talking about how in a cabinet meeting, he would turn to the people sitting on the very edge of the room, so up against the wall with their Blackberries in those days, and notepads, and whenever he needed a bit of insight, he would just say, "What do you think?" and turn to one of the junior staffers. And he said that's where he would get most of his insight from, the people who were doing the work, as opposed to the kind of big, the big egos on the kind of inner table. And his basic point was, you don't have to be the smartest guy in the room to be a leader. That leadership is about orchestrating the conversation and picking people who are smarter than you to give insight and stuff like that. And he told a cute little story about, he said, before he became president, he'd never been in the presidential suite of a hotel. And how it's a real pain because they're so massive. And you have to go around switching the lamps off and the shower nozzle is always really complicated, and you get, you know, water, boiling hot water in your face. And a lot of people like that because we were all at Dreamforce, we're all in hotels, we're all struggling with showers. And he talked about his family, and said that to his daughters he always says, be kind and be useful, which I think is quite a nice piece of advice. Mm-hmm. Be kind, be useful. What's not to like about that? Mm-hmm. Benioff himself, his keynote was interrupted though.
Mm-hmm.
He was only a couple of minutes into it when a protester from the Democratic Socialists of America stood up and started kind of saying stuff. We couldn't really hear what this guy was saying.
How many people go to Dreamforce?
Altogether about 170,000.
So he's just one man in a room. He's not mic'd up.
It takes some gumption to do that.
Yeah. It's a good job it wasn't a Trump rally, he would have been murdered on site.
Yeah. Because was it Moscone?
Yeah.
And you have to go through all of the airport security type stuff. How did he get in?
The security was much more intense.
Yeah, how did he get in? Because there were several protesters.
Well, there was three managed to get into the building, yeah. Mm. Yeah. But what they were complaining about was something that's been an issue for Salesforce for about a year or so now, because they've got this contract with the US Customs and Border Protection Agency, which controversially has been separating Latin American children from their parents at the border.
Mm.
And Salesforce is saying, no, you know, our particular software isn't involved with the separation of children from their families. Mm. We're just providing some HR software, which always struck me as a bit bizarre because Salesforce is not really known for HR software. But yeah, there's been a campaign, and Salesforce employees signed a letter saying we're not happy about this. And so that's what the protest really was about. Benioff dealt with it fairly well. He said, you've got 30 seconds to make your point, and then you have to leave the room.
Mm. Not just sit back down. Can they not just listen?
Yeah.
They carted him out.
Did they? Mm-hmm.
Do you think, because I saw a report on that, and it was like, oh, as soon as he's like, oh, you've got 30 seconds to talk, like a 30-second clock.
That's right, yeah. So it obviously had been rehearsed.
Yeah, that's what I was going to say. Did you feel like it was like, oh, hello, like, this is...
I didn't really know what was going on at first. I thought he was talking to me.
Who?
They've got 30 seconds, McKenna.
Yeah, up. Come on, your time.
Well, I thought it might be a fire thing or something, because you couldn't hear this guy from where we were.
Did they get him on stage? No.
Did he actually get on stage? He,
the protester.
I think he was kind of on the edge of the stage. It's kind of in the middle.
Right.
Thing. It happened.
Mm.
And apparently Benioff is meeting behind the scenes with the protesters. So maybe eventually that contract will be rescinded. But it's interesting, the Salesforce, because they always set themselves up, and you know this, Claire, as being very philanthropic. They give a lot back. And Benioff does give a lot of money to San Francisco to alleviate homelessness and things like that. He really does do that. And Salesforce employees give their time for good causes, etc., etc. But because they do that and they make such a big deal of it, they are therefore very vulnerable to critique if they do something that's, you know, a wee bit dodgy.
Yeah, exactly.
So there's that, and then there's also the whole cultural appropriation thing. Because, you know, they have the Hawaiian thing at the beginning.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
So he lives on Hawaii,
and
they have this thing about the Ohana.
Yeah,
oh, yeah.
Is that everyone together thing?
Mm-hmm.
The ecosystem of Salesforce. We all belong to this one big family, the Ohana. And he's a Buddhist, so there's the monks come.
Mm-hmm.
Every year he flies these monks over from France.
It's not very energy efficient.
No, carbon emissions, I'm just worrying here about.
But it is all, I don't know, I mean, it does seem like kind of appropriating someone else's culture.
Yeah.
That does happen in California, you know, that whole engagement with...
Yeah.
And any sort of music festival probably does that as well, which it sounds to me, you could probably answer this, is it trying to come across as a bit as a... bit of a music festival now in the type of vibe that it's giving off.
Dreamforce is a very strange event.
Did they have Fleetwood Mac?
They had Fleetwood Mac was the band at Dream Fest, along with Beck.
Beck is
a warm-up act.
Not bad.
And Fleetwood Mac were very, very good.
They are good.
Do you think maybe the protester should have waited for a band to play? And then it could have been like Alex from Glasto. Could have gone viral.
Well, Alicia Keys closed out his keynote.
Did she bring a piano?
Yeah, she was on stage with the piano.
Did she change the words to any of her songs? Because that often happens at Dreamforce, doesn't it?
Like Dreamforce!
They're bringing like a CRM reference.
That has happened
before, though. I remember people saying about, was it Stevie Wonder?
And actually, Benioff's keynote itself was... He kind of dialed down the change in the world stuff.
Mm.
And it was much more of a kind of product-y,
normal
technology keynote.
I suppose the world is in such a state that only so much one man can do, because he can't get on stage and like, right.
That is essentially the thing, though, like with these huge tech conglomerates and these billionaires. You can have, with the best will in the world, you can want to keep giving back to your community and charity, but surely a better system to aim for is one where that comes from taxation. So it's a system where it shouldn't be up to the billionaire how much and where they put their money.
Yeah, Mark Benioff is not keen on that.
I'm sure he's not.
In fact, he did praise Trump's, you know, taxation reduction programs. So although he's mostly on the Democrat side, and I fully expect him to be a presidential candidate at some point.
Really?
Nevertheless.
And would that be a Democrat one? Or?
It looks that way. I mean, he seems to be big friends with the Clintons and the Obamas, and so the elite, you know, the Democrat elite. Salesforce's marketing is just brilliant. It's just incredibly clever. All the wee characters they have, Einstein and the bear and all that. It's just, they create this world for you.
Astro.
It's incredibly impressive. You want to hate it, but it's so impressive.
You can't hate it.
You get drawn in.
Yeah, you get sucked in.
You do get sucked in.
It just sounds like a cult to me, all these people.
I'm sorry.
No, whole thing of Dreamforce to me just sounds almost cult-like.
Not part of
it. It's exactly what Apple have been doing for so many years, though, isn't it?
Not as successfully.
Yeah, but what do they call their sort of their main stores now? They renamed them a couple of years ago to call them City Halls or something like that.
Oh, really?
They sort of rebranded everything to make it try and sound more sort of like in sort of in union with the rest of society, as if it's seamlessly.
This is like somewhere people congregate for.
So I guess it's a competition between all these huge tech companies to win our hearts, so that anything they do, we're on board with straight away.
But Apple don't have a cute little kid in a bear onesie as their mascot.
No.
Steve Jobs died sadly a few years ago.
No, their marketing is on a different level. It really is. It's very, very engaging. No two ways about it. So there you go. Dreamforce. Some other celebrity speakers. Yeah, David Beckham.
Nice.
Doing a fireside chat with the new managing director for the UK and Ireland for Salesforce, Jainan Gadhia, and they had the Mother of Dragons,
also known as
Emilia Clarke, who was talking about, well, she's had, I think she's had two brain hemorrhages or incidents. She's got this charity called Same You, the idea being, even if you've had a brain injury, it's the same you. And apparently one in three of us will have a brain injury lives. But I did wonder, just coming back to the young tech workers in Silicon Valley and revolt, whether there's something like that in the UK. Might be worth investigating.
Yeah.
I know there was something called Coders for Corbyn.
I wonder if that's still going,
I heard of Grime for Corbyn, but the Coders are still in the background somewhere. I've not heard of those.
Well, the problem is we don't have as many techies.
No.
There's lots of people work for American IT companies in the UK, but not that many software developers, creative people. So that might be a difference, but it's worth investigating, I think. See what there might be. While many UK journalists were over at Dreamforce in San Francisco, Caroline, were left behind to attend.
Yeah, me and about two others. Yeah, we went to Google Cloud Next at Excel, which is, according to Google, it's their flagship European cloud conference for users and developers and stuff like that. It was interesting in that it's like another 6 months on from Thomas Kurian joining the company. So it was the main sort of talking points there, news-wise, was them sort of doubling down on what they're doing to really engage with enterprises, because they've still got this, I guess, a bit of a reputation, Google, but they're kind of a consumer company. You know, although it's Google Cloud, the other side of the business deals with YouTube, and it's got lots of consumer-facing services, so they're still on a bit of a charm offensive with the enterprise. So you had Thomas Kurian join from Oracle back at the start of the year, and then on stage at the show, there's something like a new set of other senior execs joining who, when you sat down and spoke to them, they're all from like SAP and Microsoft, and they've all worked there quite a long time. So it seems like they're on a bit of a hiring spree to get people who completely understand the enterprise and get more customers that way as well. So there's lots of customer conversations going on there. I spoke to John Lewis about what they're doing, their announcements about All Saints, the fashion retailer who've overhauled their website and online stuff with for online sales with Google. And then right in the middle of it all, at the end of the first day keynote, Gareth Southgate got on stage and the whole place was like, oh my God, I went a bit mad. Took part in like a sort of mini sort of fireside chat, just to talk about how the Football Association uses Google Cloud technologies. And they were announced as a customer sort of earlier this year, I think back in May. So it was just, but I think from what he's saying, they've obviously been working together a lot longer. But yeah, he was just sort of talking very, very accessibly, I'd say, right, about sort of the need for technology and how they use technology within sort of Wembley and St George's Park, which is where all the training happens for footballers and stuff like that. They use Google Cloud, kind of G Suite, so their Google Apps kind of set of technologies to sort of share data between the coaching staff about how players have performed, stuff like this. They're collecting a lot more data on how the players perform as well. GPS data, he was saying, sleep data, stuff like that, just so they can really inform the selection process. But probably one of the most interesting things was he was saying that when he first took over as England manager, I think 2016, there was no data kept on any of the past players. Yeah, so it's like 30 years of England.
Absolutely nothing at all.
But I don't think that's surprising because his predecessor, Sam Allardyce, right, he left after there was a bit of a sting, wasn't there? Yeah. And there's that famous picture of him where it looked like he was drinking a pint of wine. So
yeah,
I don't know if you've ever, if you've ever drank a pint of wine, you're not very good at note-taking afterwards. So I'm not surprised. So that was, yeah, that was really interesting. It was just like, so you turn up for the first day of work and you're just like, okay, so how do we do things around here? It's like, don't know, no one's ever kept any notes, just get on with it.
But I like how he said that the image before he got there was of sort of old men in suits, and he arrives and that's just immediately confirmed.
Yeah.
Oh, we've got some old photos from 1930.
I think a lot of what he was saying would have chimed with people in the audience who are probably going through other kind of transformations in their business. In that when you try and make a big change, it's quite hard if they've never had to do anything like that before to get people on board. So he was just saying, like, a lot of the time people would say to him, like, it's football, like, we've always done things this way, like, why would we change? You and your data, like, go away. But he confirmed, like, stuff that I found quite heartening as well, just like, oh, you know, we bring in these systems, but I'm not very good with passwords. I'm trying to get other people to learn new systems and stuff like that, even though you can say it's for the benefit of hopefully, you know, some of this data we get might just win us like a marginal gain in a game, and then, you know, we might win and stuff like that. But there was like a few talking points that were really interesting. I think the other one was just about, it's really great that you can track all this data, but you can't become too reliant on it because football is just a game of random events that can happen.
The human element.
Yeah, exactly. Mm. And he's like, you can, you know, train within an inch of your life, and then something will happen that just means, even if you've got all the possession, you've got more shots on the goal and stuff like that. Him talking about the amazing difference it's made to how they work, but at the same time, you've got to be quite measured and cautious with it. You can't read too much into this data. And stuff just about as well, like how much it's really useful for the coaching staff to have all this information, but is it useful for the players to be overloaded with all this information? Do you want them going onto the pitch being told, like, you didn't sleep very well last night, so if you're getting tired, look out for this? Or do you want them to be a bit more present and in the game?
I often wonder that, because there are some footballers that they obviously have that stereotype attached to them that all footballers just have no brain cells at all, whereas I'm sure that's very wrong in a lot of cases. But there must be certain footballers whose like learning abilities are not attuned to reading loads of data and assessing videos and reading pages and pages of notes and watching presentations, and managers are getting more and more into that now.
Yeah.
So they probably are going
to
be.
Southgate probably is the smartest guy in the room when it comes to the dressing room.
He seems like a real leader. And I've been so impressed by him since he's come in, and he's just freshened the whole thing up. Even in terms of social media in the last World Cup, to have a younger manager in charge, he seemed to sort of just know when it was okay for the players to let loose and have fun, and that connected more with people back home, and that made for a probably most exciting World Cup in a long time.
They did a lot of bonding stuff together, didn't they?
Yeah.
Like in swimming pools and stuff.
Yeah, I remember a picture of them on this inflatable unicorn.
Yeah,
that's still in my
memory. Yeah, they played a lot of Fortnite as well, I remember that being. But he was, I don't think it made it into the piece, but he said it's quite different because they are such a younger team now that you have to really tweak how you approach them with stuff. He's like, he said that when he was a player and the manager would say, right, you've got to play this way and do this and do that, you just go, okay, yeah, I'll do it. Whereas if you say that to some of the players on the team now, like, why? What's in it for me? What's the point? And he's just like,
sorry.
You never used to talk, like, people never used to talk back, but you have to be mindful of that and just, okay, that's how they need to be, they need to know what they're doing it for rather than just, like, just do it.
And that's probably all on a database now. Like each player, like on Football Manager, for example, which I've got to admit, I did download the new one the other day, and I've spent a long time playing it since. For each player, you have attributes, but you also have notes on the player, integrates well into a team, or is more of a quiet team member.
Yeah, like what their motivations are.
I do honestly believe that Football Manager and games like that have influenced real life, and coaches are now implementing that. So any information that you have on a player is going to give you that advantage. And there's no manager more renowned for that than an Argentine manager called Marcelo Bielsa, who at the start of the year was in trouble for being caught spying. And you got one of his scouts out to spy on his opposition. And when he was caught out, he defended himself by saying, we've had scouts spy on every opponent this year. And he held a press conference with loads of journalists, basically, a long PowerPoint presentation detailing, even if there was like 3 minutes that a forward had played out of position, they have notes on every single player and to the minute of how many minutes they've played in each position throughout the year. So it's like an incredible amount of detail now. So you can imagine some players are going to look at that and just go, just want to play, boss.
Yeah.
The Southgate was saying you can get so much data so quickly.
Yeah.
In the old days, it would be a VHS tape and that would be about it.
Yeah, and you'd just be like, oh, sorry, we didn't film you that day. So we don't know how you did. But yes, but he's sort of saying as well, it's a lot easier because you've obviously the national side, the component parts of it are clubs up and down the country.
Yeah.
So it's a lot easier to do remote coaching now than it ever used to be because he can maybe see two, like, I don't know where he's based, but say, for instance, you can go to like two London-based teams on a Saturday and then, you know, you've got no hope of getting up to Manchester or anything like that. So you'd have to, he gets it all, like a pre-seat of it, all the performances sent to his laptop for Sunday morning.
We do have a couple of players playing outside of England now, so we've got Jadon Sancho.
Yeah,
he's playing in Germany at the moment.
Yeah, because the clubs have been big into this data analytics stuff for a while now, haven't they?
Yeah.
Manchester City, all of them, really, all the top clubs. But if they're not willing to share,
with
the national team.
That's something he said. He didn't name names, and he was in a very sort of Gareth Southgate way. It's like, it's not a problem if they don't want to do it. It's, you know, it's up to them if they don't want to share data. But yeah, he was saying how useful...
I can almost see him saying that.
But it's like, how useful would it be when, you know, you're managing a team who have very little time on the pitch to train together to have information from their constituent clubs to sort of share, like, oh, this is how they performed, this is their injuries, this is how much, you know, their training load before they get injured again and stuff like that. And he said some clubs are really happy to share that, but then others are just like, no, it's our intellectual property, you can't have it.
I can partly understand that just through then, say you've got one player sees that data or one of the coaches, and then they end up, say for a coach, for example, then ends up joining a club, and it has all of a rival club's data.
Yeah.
That's probably one of the only reasons I can imagine they do that.
Yeah.
And did he talk about VAR as well?
No, he didn't actually, which was kind of interesting. But no, he didn't. It was very much like, what are they doing? But I think, because you just kind of think, if the whole game is getting so, technology is such a big part of the game now. But in certain instances, it still feels like it's kind of behind sport in terms of other sports in how much technology they use. So we always get invites to kind of Formula One race, like, come and see all the data and get off the cars, come and see this mobile data centre that's in the pit lane so we can get this off it and we can tell, like, the driver to do this exact turn at this exact time and off you go and you win the race through. Yeah, but then you kind of think, oh, well, they've got VAR, they've got goal line technology.
Yeah, and slowly like, catching up.
Yeah, like the referee might have a watch that tells them, oh, look, one of your linesmen's got something to tell you. Oh, okay. Which is basically a pager. So it does feel like it is getting there, football. But, yeah, do we need more technology? Don't know. And would you start detracting more from the game? Because I know that's a big problem with VAR, isn't it? That people say it slows down the pace of the game.
I think it's just, like, with anything in life, like with my uncle for years, like, we were telling him, you've got to, like, get Sky now, for example. There's so much available to you. Your quality of life would improve. But just because it was a technology that he wasn't used to, he would dismiss it. And I can imagine, like, the FA, like you said, is probably just this old boys' club.
Yeah.
This is the tradition of football.
Yeah.
You can't involve data. That's wrong.
Mm.
And so slowly, as you said, once people see the benefits of things, they become the biggest champions, as if it was their idea almost.
Yeah. Yeah.
And that's sort of happening with VAR as well, I think.
Mm.
And Germany won the World Cup in 2014 partly thanks to data from SAP. So, yeah, competitive advantage.
A lot of clubs are using that.
A lot of clubs use
the SAP one.
Yeah, City does, yeah. Cool. What have you been up to then, Claire?
But at the tail end of last week, I was at an event called Monster Confidence, which is run in partnership between STEMX, which is a social enterprise that aims to get girls into STEM, and Monster, which is like the job website. So they pair together and then they go around different cities in the UK and they get a group of school kids between the ages of like 14 and 17, so they're sort of deciding what to do after A-level, and they try and encourage them into STEM subjects and careers, just to, you know, show them the importance of STEM in their future. Basically, research suggests that girls get put off of STEM for, you know, like, various different reasons. Mm-hmm. Either they think, you know, like, there's this misconception that it's only for boys, or they think it's, you know, like, too difficult, or they think that, you know, like, creativity doesn't factor into STEM careers.
Mm-hmm.
So the whole point of the Monster Confidence events is to sort of give them the confidence that they need to go into situations like career searching and job interviews and stuff like that. So they do, you know, like job interview practice sessions and CV writing practice sessions, and it's just girls on their own in an environment at the sort of age where you start to, you know, like lose interest.
Pull up the pipeline.
Yeah, yeah, the leaky pipeline.
Yeah.
Where was it, Claire? What was the event?
So it was in this place called G Technologies, which is off Tottenham Court Road.
Right, so quite accessible then.
Yeah. Yeah, I think the girls mainly came by coach because it's like whole school classes.
Okay.
And then, yeah, they visit various different cities across the UK, so it's not just in London. Yeah, so the first event was in London, but then they go around the UK and run different events of the same thing for different regions and stuff like that.
And that'll be on the site pretty soon.
Yeah, I'm working on that today. But yeah, because I spoke to Amory Imafadon, who is the CEO of STEMX. She's been in our Women in Tech list for a long time. Okay. She was a rising star originally.
Uh-huh.
And now she's been, you know, like, in the top 10.
I was going to say, how many more years does she need to? So she's in the Hall of Fame.
Yeah.
Yeah.
We've got a new list coming out, haven't we?
The UK Tech 50?
Yeah,
so that's the top 50 people in UK tech. Including all of the tech people, but not just women.
Well, that's been fun. Sadly, run out of time. Next podcast, we've got Bill Goodwin and Sebastian Klovik-Skelton coming back to talk to us about their Facebook stories, their investigation. Claire, you going to be around for that one?
No, I'll be in Waltham Forest judging a cool thing that I'll come back and tell you about.
Mm. Well, the Christmas podcast, that's coming up.
Quickly.
Well, it just remains for me to say thank you very much indeed to Caroline.
You're welcome.
Thank you, Claire. And a big thanks to Ryan.
Thank you.
Thanks very much. And thanks to you for listening.